Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Michael Moss, who's an investigative reporter with The New York Times. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting in 2010 and was a finalist for the prize in 2006 and 1999. He's also a recipient of the Loeb Award and an Overseas Press Club Award. Before coming to The Times, he was a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His latest book just out is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Moss.
Thanks for having me.
And your book reveals an extraordinary meeting that took place in the spring of 1999 with the heads of the world's largest food processing companies, from Coca-Cola to Nabisco. They gathered at the Pillsbury headquarters in Minneapolis for a secret meeting. And on the agenda was the emergence of the epidemic of obesity and what to do about it. And it looks as though this sort of secret cartel, if you will, decided they could ultimately continue to profit from America's appalling health crisis.
You know, I have to say that, you know, researching and writing this book for me was like being inside a detective story. I was fortunate enough to come across a trove of confidential records, including memos and strategy papers and planning documents that in turn sort of helped me convince, you know, top officials at these companies to reveal more of their secrets. And the meeting you refer to was just amazingly startling to me, because it was early on in the obesity crisis. It was a rare coming together of these heads of the largest companies. And it was none other than one of their own, a senior executive at Kraft, who was well respected within the industry, who got up in front of them and essentially laid the obesity crisis at their feet, saying they were at least partly responsible and fully accountable for trying to do something to turn things around.
Well, apparently, though, the head of the most powerful person in the room is the CEO of General Mills, right? It doesn't look like he got the memo.
It doesn't look like he got the point, which was, you know, this is something that's going to or could bring the industry to its knees eventually. And you need to start thinking about it. And you know, I think like some of the other officials, the head of General Mills was very defensive. He, you know, in his view, General Mills was already acting responsibly to both its consumers and its shareholders by offering, you know, items for everybody. It had low-fat products. It had, you know, it had low-sugar products, low-salt. Whatever people wanted, it thought it was providing. And this idea from the Kraft executive that the industry should think about, you know, collectively getting together and possibly even down-formulating their products to reduce their dependence on salt, sugar, fat especially, was just abhorrent to him. And I'm sure there are also visions of lost millions in dollars.
But the facts are that the average American now eats 33 pounds of cheese, which is triple of what we ate in 1970, and 70 pounds of sugar, and 8,500 milligrams of salt a day, which is double the recommended amount. These are facts. I mean, when you are faced with the consequences of what corporate food is doing to Americans, without getting too hyperbolic, it is really gets at the heart of the responsibilities for these cartels. I mean, you know, we've had Holocaust denial for the longest time until, you know, eventually historians were able to point to meetings that took place at Wannsee where they literally sat down and knew what they were doing and they went ahead and did what they're doing. Now, obviously I'm not equating the fact that corporate food is killing Americans with those that who are producing it and peddling it. But on the other hand, they cannot escape the reality of the consequences of their products.
You know, for years they've been saying to themselves, look, you know, we never intended to make America obese or otherwise ill, but when you look at the documents and you talk to the people, it's just now overwhelmingly clear that all of their, or so much of their energy, you know, goes into the, especially these three ingredients, salt, sugar, fat, which is why I focused on them. These are the three pillars, the holy grail, if you will, on which the industry survives. Almost, you know, so much of everything in the grocery store is heavily loaded with these three. And they know from their own research that when they hit the perfect amount of these three in their formulas, they'll send us over the moon and their products will fly off the shelves and we'll eat more and we'll buy more and they, being companies, will make more money. And I think now they're coming to grips with the fact that while any, you know, individual one of their products, you know, isn't to blame, it's the collective nature of sort of the most highly processed foods and the sort of irresistible craveability, as they like to call it, that sort of drives us to buy and rely on those and over depend on those products.
But they actually have terms for this. They've done the research. They talk about this as the bliss point, where sugar beverages enhance the mouthfeel of fat by manipulating its chemical structures. So this is like a drug dealer selling you the particular qualities of the cocaine or heroin or whatever they're peddling, you know.
I spent time with a legend in the food industry named Howard Moskowitz, who coined the phrase bliss point as it applies to food. And he walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper. And, you know, it involved just sort of an extraordinary amount of high math and science and calculation with dozens and dozens of slightly varying amounts of sweet flavoring, which he then adjusted as he went along and tested on consumers. And the very perfect amount of sweetness is, and not too much, not too little, is known as the bliss point. Another of my favorite is called mouthfeel, which is that sort of warm, gooey sensation that you get when you bite into a toasted cheese sandwich. And cheese became the single largest deliverer of saturated fat into the American diet. And of course, saturated, as we know, is the fat that's linked to heart disease. And the story of how cheese became so dominant in the grocery store, not for itself, but as an ingredient in processed food, is a stunning one. And again, underlies the health problem that we're in right now.
But Michael Moss, again, investigative reporter with the New York Times, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Splendid Reporting in 2010. He's the author of the brand new book just out, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Now, I lately on television, I've noticed ads for Velveeta, for where you melt this gooey cheese into a bowl and serve it along with salt-laden chips for those couch potatoes who need them as an adjunct to watching television or basketball or whatever the sport of the moment is. So there, to me, is a direct connection between the delivery system for all of this poison that's thickening the veins and shortening the lives of American consumers. At the same time, it's tied in with a sedentary existence of watching sports. Sports, of course, being the expression of health and athleticism.
You know, I mean, I grew up on Velveeta, and one of the things about processed food is it's less expensive. And in the case of Velveeta, it's less expensive than aged cheese, and at the same time, it has more salt as part of the processing process. And I have to say, I mean, hats off to the First Lady and her Let's Move campaign. There's no question that, you know, physical activity is sort of some part of the equation, but I think it's really smart of the White House, and I happen to know they're moving this direction, to start thinking more about the economics of processed food and start looking at the huge federal subsidies that go into corn and other ingredients that are essential to highly processed food. So that when you walk into the grocery store, I mean, the current situation is that the foods that everyone says we should be eating more of, the fresh fruits and vegetables, cost so much more than the highly processed foods that the government says we should be eating less of. And so I think, you know, I think that they're beginning to struggle with the idea of how do we buck this trillion-dollar industry and start moving some of that subsidy in order to level the playing field for consumers who want to get in and out of the grocery store with their good health intact.
Well, of course, this, Michael Moss, gets to the real question about America's industrial agriculture as opposed to a sustainable and renewable form of agriculture. The United States uses 6 calories of hydrocarbon energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy. And meaning, of course, that ultimately our food prices are tied to our oil prices. You have total federal irrigation subsidies estimated to be $22 billion. And while the giant Aguala aquifer that irrigates $20 billion in agricultural products in the Great Plains is being drained at a rate of 18 Colorado rivers each year, with recharge rates of less than 0.1% of the withdrawal rate. Then you have fertilizer-intensive agriculture that's led to the rapid soil depletion, while nitrogen-rich farm effluent is poisoning our waterways and choking off the spawning grounds of estuaries and shell fisheries. And just the bottom line is that in 2010, the estimate is that the total value of direct and indirect federal agriculture subsidies amounted to $180 billion in 2009, over half of total U.S. farm revenues. So already we have this massive government intervention in the farming sector, which former Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman referred to as a largely an income transfer program. So isn't that the problem? We have a form of kind of right-wing corporate welfare?
Wow. Well, you've just hit on a dozen huge things. I mean, you know, in my book, I write about this Kraft official and others kind of touching what I thought was the third rail, which was comparing processed food and our dependence on processed foods to tobacco. And ironically, you may recall that Philip Morris was the largest food manufacturer in this country for years and years during the main surge of the obesity crisis. And Philip Morris did some really, really interesting things when it comes to its food division that I go into in the book. But, you know, I mean, I think that to some extent our focus on food is still fairly self-centered, and more Americans are becoming concerned about what we put into our bodies and the health effects of that. And I think that the industry is finally waking up to the notion that at stake for it is the public trust. But, you know, you're going beyond that now and sort of raising these custodial, environmental, sort of social issues that go even further. And you know, it's conceivable that, you know, this situation that the processed food industry has put itself into could lead to much broader discussions about, you know, just what is this industry in relation to our society, and what really do we need moving forward? I have to tell you, though, the industry likes to talk about something called food security, which is feeding the world's growing population. So you're going to see an even sort of tougher clash on these issues. You're going to see the companies stand up and say, hey, you know, nutrition is one thing, but we need to get just lots of calories into lots of bodies. And, you know, and I'm afraid you're going to see, like I say, an even greater clash, you know, on environment versus get calories into bodies.
Well, you mentioned, Michael Moss, that the First Lady has made efforts to educate America's children and parents about nutrition. And to some extent, they've recognized the link between corporate food and corporate agriculture and this cartel, if you will, that have we're talking about. That's a source, you know, that's very much what your book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, is about how their power. And, of course, that gets down to the very basic questions of our politics. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me at the moment that that this so-called sequester business is really, again, about the power of big money in the sense that the Republicans are going to the mat for the 1%. That's ultimately what this is about. The Senate's refusing to pick up any bills. They don't want this president to succeed. So as much as one can be proud of the First Lady's efforts, we have some serious structural questions in this country about corporate power versus the public good.
Yeah, and it's a power issue, too, on a very sort of smaller level. I talk about in the book how, you know, in this country, we used to have a home economics program in schools that taught both girls and boys how to shop and cook and prepare meals by scratch and basically be in control of what they're putting in their bodies. That fell by the wayside as the largest food companies, you know, hijacked the home economics program and hired and created their home economists who began urging people to buy convenience foods. And that's sort of a remarkable shift. You know, the epitome of that was Betty Crocker, who I always thought was a real person. She was a figment of the imagination of a marketing executive, and the Betty Crocker kitchens cropped up all over, you know, guiding people toward convenience foods. And again, I see the White House looking at ways to restart home economics so that, you know, the next generation can have control and more power over what they're eating and how they're eating and sort of understand the things you're talking about as well.
But, of course, the sad part of this, Michael Moss, is that the poorest people in this country, the people on food stamps, they're the ones that essentially rely more and more on this cheap processed food because it feeds more of their hungry mouths. You've got these unfortunate, the facts are that single family households, an overworked mother trying to feed a bunch of kids on very limited resources.
You know, I spent time in a very poor neighborhood in Philadelphia where the incoming principal of a school with those poor performing, you know, realize that if she's going to bring grades up in this neighborhood, and this used to be one of the most violent neighborhoods, Philadelphia, where crack epidemics were rampant, she had to address the eating habits of their kids because they were hitting all the corner stores that ring the school. And she went to the stores and pleaded with them, and they refused to stop selling to the kids in the morning. The kids could come in with a dollar and come out with, you know, 300 empty calories. And she got the parents of these kids to stand out on the corner to try to deflect the kids from dashing into the store on the way to school. And I thought that was so heartening that these people of the most modest means, you know, were educating themselves on nutrition and devoting some of the hours of their day to helping their kids and change their environment. I just found that was really heartening and should be totally motivating to the rest of us who have more resources and time and education.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Moss, as an investigative reporter with the New York Times. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting in 2010 and was a finalist for the prize in 2006 and in 1999. He's also the recipient of the Loeb Award and the Overseas Press Club Award. Before coming to the New York Times, he was a reporter with the Wall Street Journal and the Atlantic Journal Constitution. And his latest book just out is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to the Syrian-Turkish border for an update on the Syrian civil war.